Looking to refresh your closet, home, or beauty routine this spring? Walmart's got all the stylish goods in one stop. From chic new looks and the latest makeup to quality furniture and tableware. Go to walmart.com/nowtrending. That's walmart.com/nowtrending for the hottest fashion, home, and beauty finds. Your style at Walmart.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
We laid on the beach. Matt was trying to decide if his back hair counted as SPF instead of putting on lotion, right?
Oh, it's going to be one of those episodes.
Okay. Wrote that in the book.
Well, let me just get my notes out. And yeah. Karen was laying there.
Welcome to the Dear Bob and Sue podcast, stories from our journey to all the U.S. national parks and other public lands. I'm Karen Smith.
And I'm Matt Smith. We're the authors of the Dear Bob and Sue series of books. This is our monthly mailbag episode where we answer questions from listeners about the national parks, hiking trails, camping, road trips, outdoor gear, and a lot of other travel-related topics.
Today, we're discussing hiking trails in the state of Washington, where a listener can find golden larches in the fall, and some national parks that are good for small children and someone with limited hiking mobility.
And we'll talk about our visit to Virgin Islands National Park and what we wish we would have done differently. Plus, which hard-to-get-to park was our favorite and why?
We'll also offer suggestions about a listener's Utah park itinerary, as well as an overview of the ranger-led tours in Mesa Verde.
And how hard is it to find a campsite in a national park campground without a reservation? Find out on this episode of Mailbag.
Wow, Matt.
I know, I gave it a little extra.
Hey, Karen, I thought we would try something different on this episode.
Oh, great. What do you have in mind?
I thought we would start with some park news. Do you have any park news?
Are you making fun of me?
Yes. That's what I do. It's my job.
I think the park news is going to become a new segment on some of the episodes. In fact, maybe when we don't have History Channel, we could do park news, although sometimes they might overlap. You never know.
You could do like breaking news. Sound effect? Because I know you love the sound effects, and you don't put a lot of sound effects in the episodes, but you could right there.
That's actually a really good idea. I could probably find something that sounds just a little more professional.
Are you making fun of me?
No, I like where you're going with it. That's actually a brilliant idea.
All right, so let's talk about some park news, Karen.
Okay, so out of Rocky Mountain National Park in Colorado, I thought this was really interesting. They have, and I believe this is the only national park to have this, they have transponders for visitors to use to go through the fast lane at the park entrance.
Yeah, that's a unique idea for the national parks, although they've been around for like decades. It makes total sense. For people who have annual passes or annual passes, lifetime passes, any kind of America the Beautiful pass, you can just go right through the transponder lane.
Exactly, and no waiting. So you do have to have one of the annual or lifetime passes because obviously you're not paying money when you go through the transponder lane. So in order to get a transponder, which are available to buy at the Rocky Mountain National Park Visitor Center, the Beaver Meadows Visitor Center, you do have to have an annual pass.
So if you have a senior pass, which is what we have, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Military, veterans, access, fourth grade, and volunteer passes. Those are all good?
Those are all good.
What about golden age and golden access passes?
Those are good too, Matt.
What is a golden age?
Because
we got the senior. Is there something above senior?
that I don't know about?
Aren't we in the golden age?
I thought we were at the top. Yes, it is. These are our golden years. I guess.
Okay, we'll have to look that up. Golden age and golden access.
Yeah, we have no idea.
Oh my gosh, we were right. A golden age pass is the older version of the senior pass. And because they're a lifetime pass, they're still valid. It says here that the NPS encourages visitors with a golden age passport to exchange it for a new senior lifetime pass for free.
They should have stuck with the old name.
I know, golden age passport. That does sound a lot better.
Yeah.
Okay, so the way the transponder works is currently there is only a transponder lane at the Beaver Meadows entrance, but they are working on getting them in the Fall River entrance and also over on the west side at the Grand Lake entrance. And it costs $15 to purchase this transponder, and it's good for 1 year. And then if you want to renew it, it costs $5.
However, there is a little bit of a glitch that they are going to close the transponder lanes in the summertime from 9 a.m. to 2 p.m. because during those hours, you need a timed entry pass. So you can't just go in and out. So they're going to close the transponder lane and then you have to wait in line like everyone else.
I know. And that is kind of a downside because obviously this transponder lane, you know, you would want to buy the transponder to get in and out quickly and avoid the line. But when those timed entry reservations are in effect, the lines are long. And yes, you would have to sit in those lines to show them that you have a timed entry. But I think the purpose of this, and hopefully they're going to expand it to other parks, this would be for like a lot of local people, right?
Right. And there could be a lot of people who have to travel between Estes Park and Grand Lake, mm-hmm. just the course of business and things that they have to do, and they have to go through the park. You just can't make those people wait in line like everyone else. It is a highway.
Right, right. And, you know, I could see this would be hugely valuable at Zion National Park, because that's kind of the same thing. You have to take that highway through the park to get to the other side.
Well, I would imagine, we don't know this for a fact, but I would imagine that this is a test. And if it goes well, they'll use what they learn at Rocky Mountain to implement it at other parks.
I think this would be perfect for Yellowstone because the entrances at Yellowstone are really backed up during the busy times, and they don't have any day use reservation policies. So, man, wouldn't it be nice to go to Yellowstone and then just zip right in?
It would be. We talked to a park ranger one time, and she told us that it gets backed up so far at that West Yellowstone entrance during the summertime that sometimes the local authorities at West Yellowstone, the town, they call the park service and say, you got to do a flush. They call it a flush, which means that they just open the gates and everyone goes through. No one stops, shows their passes, pays their fee, because they have to flush the cars out of town because the line is backed up so far into West Yellowstone that it's literally blocking all the local traffic.
That is wild.
So this would be kind of like a permanent flush, a flush lane.
Right.
They could call it the flush lane.
I'm not sure they're going to come to you for marketing advice, Matt.
Well, I'm not sure I'm going to offer my marketing advice for free.
And, you know, one other thing to consider, if you're only visiting a park for 1 or 2 days, are you going to pay $15 for a transponder, you know, to get in for 1 or 2 days? Maybe you are, to avoid the line. But boy, if you're there for a week, I would absolutely spend the $15 and consider it money well spent.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So that's what's going on in Rocky Mountain. And yeah, we'll be curious to see if it continues in any other parks.
All right. We have some more park news. You have a sad face drawn around this one, Karen. The Claylock Lodge cabins in Olympic National Park. Some of them are about to be torn down.
I was really sad to read this yesterday. So starting on March 11th, a contractor from Port Angeles is going to start tearing down some of the cabins at the Claylock Lodge. There are 10 of them that are slated for removal because they sit along the edge of the bluff overlooking the ocean. And apparently they've become unsafe for occupancy because the cliffside, the bluff, is eroding away.
And this erosion happened quickly. I think it began in December of 2023. And just within weeks, they had lost 10, 15 feet of bluff. And it just was encroaching on these cabins. And now some of them are at the point where it's just not stable anymore.
Right.
They're so close to the bluff.
Right. And boy, when these storms hit at the coastline in Olympic, it is something to see. They have king tides, winter storms. There are also what they call freeze-thaw events, and all of those erode the bluff beneath the cabins. So I was really sad to read this, well, for a lot of reasons, but we just stayed there last January for the first time at Calais Lock Lodge. And by the way, this does not affect the lodge itself or some of the other cabins, but we didn't stay in those bluff cabins because it cost more.
It cost more?
to have an ocean view. Yeah. So I believe when you booked them, we booked the ones behind the view ones.
Which now have an ocean view.
You know, these weren't necessarily historic cabins. The lodge and the cabins were built sometime in the 1950s, but it's still really sad. If you've never been there, these are, I don't know, they have such a beachy vibe. Were they made of driftwood? No, they weren't made of driftwood.
No, you're answering your own questions.
Sorry, that was stupid.
Do you have any other questions for yourself? Were they made of sand? No, they weren't made of sand either.
Disregard that question. Okay. That was dumb. They were not made of driftwood, but super cozy on the inside. We loved staying there. So hopefully you will get a chance sometime to stay at the Calais Lock Lodge in one of the cabins that will not be torn down.
Right.
Obviously, it's going to be a little harder to get now because there will be less of a selection.
That's right. Super cozy. That's more cozy than just cozy.
Mm-hmm.
Super cozy.
We loved it.
Yeah, we did enjoy those cabins. But the good news is it's not affecting all the cabins. There will be cabins left. Even if a lot of that bluff goes, there's a second row of cabins. I think there's even a third row. So Mother Nature, do your best. But there will still be cabins.
There will still be cabins. And it's a great location to stay if you are exploring the coastline.
Okay, let's get to our questions, because Karen, this is a mailbag episode.
It is. All right. And the first question we have comes from Angie in Utah. And she wrote, I am really wanting to see some fall larches. I know things change from year to year, but do you think the first week of October would give me a good chance to see those trees in beautiful yellow? We will be flying into Seattle. I'm looking at the Enchantments and Maple Pass for hiking. Are these good options for larches? Any other suggestions?
Yeah, the larches. We didn't know anything about larches when we moved to the Pacific Northwest over 25 years ago. We thought for a good 5 or 6 years they were birds.
We did. People would talk about, we have to go see the larches.
We have to go see the larches. And I thought, well, I think I just saw one in our tree in the backyard a few minutes ago. Our cat was trying to climb up the tree and get the larch, but it's not a bird. It is maybe the only kind of conifer tree that actually loses its needles.
I know. It's very special in that way. These larches are deciduous. So in October-ish, their needles turn a pale yellow, and then they kind of get darker, and then they are almost orange, and then they all fall off.
And then you think they're dead.
Right. You think they're dead, and then they come back again in the spring. But it is a short period of time to see these yellow, beautiful yellow trees. And it's not always guaranteed exactly when that's going to happen.
Yeah. The season does go pretty quick. You'll see them turn yellow higher up, and then it moves down. They also call these trees tamaracks. So they're tamarack trees are also larches.
That's right. In the past, when we have posted photos of the larches turning color on our social media accounts, we would get a lot of people calling them tamaracks. And I hadn't heard that before, so I looked it up. And apparently, here in the Pacific Northwest, what we have is called the Western larch. But the term tamarack refers to kind of smaller trees that live in boggy areas and are more commonly found in the eastern United States and Canada. So it kind of depends where it is as far as what you would call it.
Good to know. I thought a tamarack was a bird.
And did you look for it in your life list of birds book?
Yeah, I did. And surprisingly, I could not find it. I looked several times for tamarack.
Okay, so Angie, when do the larches change color? You mentioned October, and yes, that's when it happens, but when in October? I looked back through our years of larch photos, because we try to do a hike every year, to see the date stamps. And, you know, it was anywhere from October 2nd through October 8th. So I wouldn't come too early. I wouldn't come on the 1st probably, but maybe the 5th or 6th.
It is hard to catch it.
Things change so quickly. And then the other thing that can happen too is, when the larches are in all their glory, right, and they're just brilliant, sometimes then it can be really windy and snowy, and it can bring a quick end to the larch season and cause all the needles to fall off. So it is unpredictable, but we'll give you some of our best advice.
Okay, let's start with the enchantments, which is one of the places she mentioned. It's a great place to see larches. If you're going to do it as a through hike, it's over 20 miles, and it's treacherous in a couple of spots. It's kind of difficult. You can apply for a permit to camp, but those permits are issued by lottery, really difficult to get. People, you know, apply for these for 10, 20 years in a row and still don't get them. So really your best bet at just coming in and going up to the enchantments is a through hike, which is 20 plus miles.
Right. And because the days are shorter, you're going to be starting in the dark. You're going to be ending in the dark. Also, when you do the through hike, you start in one parking lot and you end up in another parking lot. So you have to arrange for transportation. So we, for all those reasons, we wouldn't recommend the enchantments because there are much easier ways to see larches.
Right.
Now, at the base of the enchantments, a lot of people hike to Kolchuk Lake to see larches. You know, that's not our favorite because you don't actually see the larches until you get to Kolchuk Lake itself. It's a long and strenuous hike, and then you're just viewing the larches from a distance. We like to go on hikes where you are walking through a little magical larch forest.
I do like the Kolchuk Lake trail, but if you're just going to, you know, try to see the changing of the colors, there's better places to do that.
Right. Now, you mentioned Maple Pass Loop, and this is up in the North Cascades National Park Complex. This Heather Maple Pass Loop will probably always be the very most crowded large hike.
Yeah, because it's easy to get to. Mm-hmm. It's right off the highway, and it used to be we would tell people, well, just go get there early in the morning, go midweek, and you'll be fine. Well, that trick doesn't work anymore either because it's so popular. It's still worth going.
Yes, yes, absolutely. Now, I know, Angie, that you have been to Washington State to hike in the summer before, and maybe you have already done Maple Pass Loop. If you have, then I would skip it and do a couple of these other ones that we'll talk about. And one is, this is a lot shorter. You could do a couple hikes in a day if you do this one, and that's Blue Lake.
Yeah, Blue Lake's great. Good views, pretty hike, and it is less strenuous. It's shorter. Mm-hmm. So that's one option.
Right.
The other is Cutthroat Pass or Rainy Pass to Cutthroat Pass. That's just right across the highway from the Maple Pass area. Also crowded. However, that's a fantastic hike.
Yes, I think Cutthroat Pass might be my favorite, and that's the one I think we would recommend over the Maple Pass because it's less crowded. So there are two different hikes. Across the way from Maple Pass, there is a parking lot, and there's a trailhead to Rainy Pass. So you could hike up that trail, and at the top, you are at Cutthroat Pass, and then you can turn around and hike back down. That's beautiful. Or you drive Highway 20 around, you're driving now further east to the parking lot for Cutthroat Pass, and you just hike up to Cutthroat Pass and back to your car. So two different ways to do either of those hikes. Both are absolutely gorgeous.
And it's also fun to do these because the PCT winds through there, and you get a sense. I always like getting a sense of what the PCT through hikers are seeing. And a lot of them, if you're going to do the Pacific Crest Trail from Mexico to Canada, which is the direction most people do it, a lot of thru hikers are getting to these areas about this same time of the year.
Right.
We've actually run into some.
We have, and that's fun to see too. Now, there's one that's somewhat unknown, and this is a little further to the east near Mazama, and it's called Goat Peak Lookout, and you're actually hiking up to a fire lookout, and there are some really pretty larches up there.
Yeah, the area in and around Mazama is really interesting, and like you said, it's a little less crowded because most of the people who are going out to do these hikes are coming from the west, from the metropolitan area, the Seattle greater metropolitan area, which is to the west. And so they hit the first really good trails and they stop and do those. Mazama is a little bit further east, so you have fewer crowds.
Right. Now, if you're going to do the Goat Peak Lookout, you do have to drive several different Forest Service roads unpaved. It seems like a long drive to get to the trailhead. So definitely check the road conditions before you go. Make sure that, you know, the roads are open and that they are passable in whatever kind of rental car that you have.
Now, there is another area that has great larch hikes. And one of the trails that we like to do is Lake Ingalls. And this is on the southern side of the Enchantments from Seattle. You get there from I-90, you go to Clay Elum, the little town of Clay Elum, and then you go north from there through the Tiana Way.
I love this hike. This is a fantastic hike. If you're going up to North Cascades, I don't know if you can swing this because, you know, it would be a long drive around to get to Lake Ingalls. But a couple of things. You'll be hiking through some magical groves of yellow larches, and you're highly likely to see mountain goats up there.
Yeah, we saw mountain goats. We saw them very close. We came around a bend, and they were just right there, spectacular. Got some good photos of them. They're just a spectacular animal to see in the wild.
And at the trailhead to Lake Ingalls, there are a couple other hikes that also have larches. And not too far away is Blewett Pass, that area. And there is a great larch hike there called Tronson Ridge. So this general area also has great larch hikes, just like the North Cascades area.
Yeah, and if you're going to travel to do this, make sure that you bring, really, you need to be prepared for any kind of weather. It could be warm and it can be cold, so bring warm gloves, bring hats, bring your micro spikes. Mm-hmm. You probably need those.
Yes.
You know, it snows on us almost every year when we do this.
Well, exactly. It's unpredictable, but I would say chances are it's going to be cold and it's probably going to be snowy because you're up at high elevations on these hikes. Now, one other tip, if you have any choice in the matter, try not to come on a weekend because the crowds are magnified on the weekends. Try to come midweek. And also, if you're doing these North Cascades hikes, as Matt said, a lot of people are driving in from the Seattle area, which is, you know, takes a couple hours to get there. So if you can stay out there, get a hotel room maybe in Winthrop where you are right close to the trailhead and you can get there early, you'll find parking and you can beat the crowds.
Okay, so that's about all the larch information you could ever want.
Yes, good luck. I hope it works out for you. It will be worth your trip from Utah.
Okay, Karen, can you... The bag's over by you. Could you reach down in there and grab the next envelope?
All right, let's see what we have.
So professional.
Okay. This one is from Nora in Lubbock, Texas. Isn't that a song? Am I thinking of Lukenbach, Texas?
Yeah, I have no idea. If I knew what you were thinking, that would be a whole... Be a whole different episode, but I have no clue what you're thinking. All right. Let's get back to the mailbag.
Okay. She wrote, I was wondering if you have an episode about Virgin Islands National Park that I may have missed, or if not, could you do an episode about Virgin Islands or perhaps talk about Virgin Islands in a mailbag episode?
Have we not talked about the Virgin Islands before?
Well, not in a full-length episode. I think we might have mentioned it in a previous mailbag episode, but I can't seem to find any record of us doing so.
We really don't know what's in our library of episodes.
Well, in our defense, so we don't sound ridiculous.
Yes, yes.
Okay, I would like to hear this. What defense do you have for us being disorganized?
What we struggle with is trying to remember what we have talked about in a mailbag episode and what we have talked about in those episodes where we group parks together. Like, let's say we talk about five national monuments or five state parks, that kind of thing. That's where we have trouble remembering.
Also, we have, guys, probably 30 episodes over on our Patreon account.
Oh, yes.
Shameless plug for our Patreon account. Thank you for all of you patrons who support us there.
But we know for sure we have not done a full-length episode of Virgin Islands, and that is because we have no advice to offer people who are planning trips to Virgin Islands.
Yeah, we didn't explore that national park as much as we could have. We went to Keneal Bay. We sat there and drank painkillers and didn't hike a lot, partly because it was raining cats and dogs most of the time. So we've been there, but we don't have a lot of advice.
Well, no, because here's the thing, too. When we stayed at Keneal Bay Resort, we were actually in the national park at the time. That is part of the national park, and it's a huge property. So we spent our time going to the beaches inside the Keneal Bay Resort. Now, you can't do that anymore because the resort has been destroyed, and we'll talk about that in a minute. We made the mistake of not renting a car when we were there because a ferry took us from St. Thomas right to the dock at Keneal Bay. We didn't need to get any transportation on our own. So since we didn't rent a car, we couldn't visit the other sections of the park.
Well, we did ask the park ranger about taking a taxi or, you know, hiring somebody to drive us to places, but he said, well, you could do that, but you might not be able to get back because there is not cell coverage everywhere. And so how are we going to call a taxi to get you back to the resort? So, yeah, we just decided to, when it wasn't raining cats and dogs, just go to the beach.
That's right. We also were close enough. We could walk into the town. The main town there is called Cruz Bay. That's where the visitor center is. So we actually, there was a trail we could walk, hike in the rain, in the pouring rain, to the visitor center, take care of business. We'd go have lunch at, you know, an outdoor, well, not an outdoor place, but like a thatched roof hut kind of place. It was very fun.
Yeah, and that's where I got Coco Lopez.
Well, exactly. We got some supplies so we could make our own painkillers. So we did kind of get out and about. But I wanted to talk about the reason that we, you know, can't recommend staying at Keneal Bay Resort is because it was destroyed back in 2017 by two, not just one, but two back-to-back Category 5 hurricanes.
Right, Hurricanes Irma and Maria. They not only destroyed Keneal Bay Resort, but they devastated the entire island of St. John and all the other nearby islands.
So Keneal Bay is interesting because this resort was located on a 150-acre peninsula. It's located on the northwest side of the island, and it was originally developed by Lawrence Rockefeller beginning in 1956. So he had donated over 5,000 acres of land to the National Park Service, and he saved this 150 acres for what he called the Jackson Hole Preserve, which was a Rockefeller family land trust. But then in 1983, this was donated to the U.S. government for use within Virgin Islands National Park. So this became Keneal Bay Resort.
And the only lodging inside the national park.
When we visited in 2010, you know, our circumstances were different back then. We were not writing a book. We hadn't thought of writing a book. We certainly didn't have a podcast. We never dreamed that any of this would happen to us. So we weren't particularly concerned with like researching other places so we could report back.
We weren't professional journalists back then.
We weren't anything.
No, we weren't anything. Kind of like now.
We laid on the beach. Matt was trying to decide if his back hair counted as SPF instead of putting on lotion, right?
Oh, it's going to be one of those episodes.
No, you okay. Wrote that in the book.
Well, let me just get my notes out. And yeah. Karen was laying there.
And And then he would walk back and forth from the beach to our room, which was quite a walk, by the way. I mean, maybe a mile, to make painkillers and bring them back to me on the beach, because we found out that if we bought one, they were what, like $20 each?
A guy comes around in his golf cart and charges us $20 each. Mm-hmm. And yeah, we're not doing that again since the Coco Lopez is just a quarter mile walk away.
So let's recap. Anyone wanting to know about our stay in Virgin Islands, there was laying on the beach, there was drinking painkillers, there was one of those giant iguanas with the neck thing that was hanging down.
Yeah, it flared its neck thing at me. I didn't know. I thought, I didn't know if they could fly. I don't know if they were biters. I didn't know anything. I'd had a few painkillers, so I was trying to steer clear of that. And then as I'm doing all this, the security guard, he stopped me.
Oh, yes.
Wanted ID.
He was sure you couldn't have been a guest in this beautiful resort.
I keep my ID in my swim trunks because that's where I keep it on vacation.
But, you know, this resort had everything that you would need, which is why we barely left. They had a really nice restaurant outside and we had dinner there. So that was kind of our story about Virgin Islands, is we just don't have a lot of all the rest of the park, which I'm sure is fantastic.
Well, it's the whole reason why we wrote the book, is to tell people how not to go visit all the parks.
Right. Now, the good news is the National Park Service wants to build a new resort there, you know, to replace what was Keneal Bay. They're facing a lot of issues, though. There are some environmental contaminations that they have to deal with. So there's a lot going on before this can even get off the ground. But boy, if they could build a resort there, that would be something. I would love to go back. Well, I'd love to go back regardless and just see what we missed.
Right. Yeah, but we got a long list of places to visit, Karen. So I don't know when that's going to happen.
Yes. So hopefully there are some other people out there who have better advice for you regarding Virgin Islands.
Today's specials are brought to you by Fancy Feast. From impeccable pâtés to silky broths to chef-inspired creations, a memorable mealtime experience is always on the menu for your cat. Learn more at fancyfeast.com. Together we're as happy as
can be. Okay, so that's Virgin Islands. Karen, I think we have a few more questions.
Yes, this next one comes from Liz in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, and she wrote, I have two parts to this mailbag question. Number one, what was your favorite hard-to-get-to park and what made it so special?
Hard-to-get-to park. You want to go first?
Yes, I'll go first. Mine would be Katmai National Park and Preserve in Alaska. That was hard to get to. And I think what makes that so special, not just for us, but for anyone who goes, is the chance to see the brown bears up close. They are everywhere. They're walking on the trails. They are fishing for salmon in the river and in the lake. And so it's just really an unbelievable experience.
It really is. And just so people know, the bears are abundant around Brooks Camp, which is where there's a set of cabins, when the salmon run. And those are specific times, usually late June, early July is one run. And then there's another run of salmon, I think, in early September. So if you go at other times, there will be fewer bears around the camp. However, people have told us there are other parts of the park that are incredible to see. But going to Brooks Camp inside Katmai National Park when the salmon are running and being that close to the bears, that was really pretty cool.
It was. Did you have another one, Matt, or are you agreeing?
Well, I like that. I also liked Glacier Bay National Park, also in Alaska, in southeastern Alaska. I just thought that was a spectacular park just to see. The boat tour was amazing. It used to be a glacier all the way to the ocean. Now that a lot of the glacier has melted, so you take a boat tour back into the park. A lot of wildlife. You're probably going to see moose, probably going to see brown bears also. But yeah, I like that. It's a little harder to get to because they only fly the 737s into that little town of Gustavus for a few months of the year. But we literally got the last plane out.
Right. And the cool thing about this, too, I loved our boat tour to the glacier. I mean, just seeing this massive, massive blue glacier was incredible. But the other thing, too, is, you know, Matt was talking about the wildlife. When you're on the boat, then you also see a lot of ocean wildlife as well. So seals and otters and sea lions. And if you're lucky, you'll see a whale or two. And that's another plus. So, yeah, those two parks, wow, they were both really phenomenal.
But Karen, Liz from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania has a second part to her question.
Yes, and number two is this. I know that Isle Royale is among the least visited parks, but as a Pennsylvania resident, I dream of checking it off our national park bucket list. We have two young kids who camp, hike, and explore with us. Do you think it's feasible to take preschool / elementary children up to this park?
Yeah, I think you can. I mean, getting to the park is not difficult if you just have to find the ferry. There's ferries from the Minnesota side. There's also ferries from the Michigan side. So I think getting kids to the park is not any more difficult than adults getting there.
I agree. And kids would probably love the boat ride up there.
Liz, I don't know if you had a chance to listen to our Isle Royale episode number 107, but we mentioned our stay at the housekeeping cabins at Rock Harbor Lodge. It's ideal for families with kids.
Right. Now, as far as their enjoyment level, I would say that because you qualified your question and you put kids who camp, hike, and explore with us, then we would say, yes, absolutely take them. If someone out there, however, has children who are not outdoorsy, then I wouldn't recommend this park because I just don't think there's enough to do for kids who, you know, don't want to hike or fish or throw rocks in the lake and that kind of thing.
Yeah. And take bug spray.
Yes.
Pretty much any time of the year.
Yes. Take bug spray. But if you have outdoorsy kids, then you should absolutely take them up there.
Thanks for the question, Liz. And that transitions perfectly to our next question, which is also about kids in the national parks.
Yes, this one is from Chelsea, and she wrote, "Hi, I'm a mom of little ones, and I have a husband with a past leg injury that makes hiking difficult trails a no-go. Do you have any recommendations for great places / trails to visit that are not a lot of walking in the national parks? We haven't visited any yet, so we are just beginning our adventure."
All right.
So, Matt, kid-friendly and a park that has short, easy trails.
Well, there are a lot of places that qualify for that, but we do have a specific recommendation, and that is go to the Black Hills in South Dakota.
Yes. Yes. That would be our number one piece of advice for you because it's very kid-friendly, and there are lots of things you can do, outdoorsy things that don't require a long hike.
Right. You got the Badlands where the kids can climb on rocks. There are a few trails there that are fairly short that kids could do, your husband could do. You got the Door, Window, and Knox trails. All three of those all start from the same parking lot on the east side of the park. So you got that.
And then right next to Badlands, you have the little town of Wall, South Dakota, and you have to make a stop at the Wall Drugstore. It's a little bit like an amusement park. Besides selling everything you could ever want, there's like this giant jackrabbit the kids can climb on. There's what, that dinosaur, Matt? That
animatronic dinosaur. And can we just go back? You like the jackrabbit a little bit too much. So... But there is a giant jackrabbit. You can climb up and sit on it. But there are other people waiting in line to do the same thing and get their picture taken. So just move right on over to the animatronic dinosaur.
Right, yeah. Right. Lots of fun. They also sell ice cream and they sell donuts. And so you can stop in at Waldrug. Another thing that your kids might love is from the little towns of Hill City to Keystone, there is the 1880 train that runs through those. Fun to take a little train ride.
Now, also at the center of the Black Hills is Custer State Park, and the things you can do there, you can drive the wildlife loop to look for wildlife. Oftentimes, there are bison, and sometimes there's donkeys. You might want to also then just keep going south into Wind Cave National Park, which is adjacent to Custer State Park, and they also have a lot of bison. So if you're on the hunt for bison, that's a great place to see them.
And then Custer State Park also has a different area you could explore. Drive the Needles Highway and spend some time at the beautiful Sylvan Lake. Just get out your folding chairs and sit by the lake. The kids could wade in. There's huge boulders to climb. There's a little trail that goes around Sylvan Lake. I think it's about a mile. So that's a beautiful place to spend time in as well.
Yeah, there's Mount Rushmore. Everyone should see Mount Rushmore. Mm-hmm. I know some people complain that it gets crowded and it's not really much of a park because it's you're just looking at the carvings. That's something I think every American should see at least once.
And then, of course, in that same area, you have Jewel Cave National Monument. Matt already mentioned Wind Cave National Park. And then in addition to all that, as you're in this general area of the Black Hills, there's tons of activities for kids. There are rock shops and there's miniature golf and there's just all kinds of fun things for kids to do.
There's also a mammoth site in Hot Springs, South Dakota, which is just south of this area.
Right. And we have not been there yet, but everyone tells us that's a great spot to take kids. So you might want to check that out too.
Okay. So Black Hills is a great place, but Karen, there are some others.
Yeah. And we won't go into a lot of detail on these. I'll just list some of these. Arches National Park in Utah is another great park for you to go to because lots of rocks for the kids to climb on and a lot of really short, easy trails to go and see the arches.
Yeah, Rocky Mountain National Park in Colorado. That's mm-hmm. a great place to visit. And you have towns on either side of it. Estes Park is the bigger of the two towns. It has a lot of things for kids. And you got Grand Lake on the west side.
Right. And we just did an episode on Joshua Tree National Park in Southern California. A fantastic place for kids. Again, there are boulders to climb. And there are a ton of really short trails in Joshua Tree where you can see the iconic Joshua trees.
And you also have the sand parks, right? You got great sand dunes in Southern Colorado. You got Indiana Dunes, that's right on Lake Michigan. You got White Sands National Park in southern New Mexico. Also Carlsbad Caverns, which is not that far from White Sands. So if you're going to go to White Sands National Park, you got to add Carlsbad Caverns on that.
Yes, White Sands and Carlsbad would be a great combo for your family because White Sands, you know, they can do the little sand sledding. Carlsbad Caverns, I don't need to say anything more about that. Everyone knows how much I love it, but your husband could take the elevator down and up and then that self-guided big room tour. I don't know. I think it's about a mile or so, but it's easy and it's paved.
Right.
So hopefully that wouldn't be an issue for him.
And it's air conditioned.
And it's air conditioned and it's amazing.
Right.
And then, of course, we have to mention Yellowstone National Park because that's another great park for kids. And there are so many boardwalks where it's easy walking. You know, you walk out to these really cool thermal features and geysers and mud pots. So that would be a spectacular park for your family also.
And also here in Washington State, you got Olympic National Park. That would be a good one because there are a lot of easy short hikes.
Yes. And the thing, too, about Olympic is the tide pooling along the coast, along the beaches, if you go at low tide, is phenomenal. And how much would kids love wading in the water, looking at the starfish, looking at all of these creatures? Olympic is a fantastic park for kids.
Squeals of joy.
Squeals of joy. Right. And from me, too,
from
this
also.
Big kid. Yeah. So I hope that gives you a start on your list since you're new to the parks, you know, and talk to the ranger when you go, and they will also advise you on, you know, fun things for your kids to do and easier hikes for your husband.
All right. Thanks for the question. Karen, what's our next one?
Okay. This one comes from Gary in Wisconsin. This is a two-parter. The first part says, I have a couple questions about my upcoming vacation, the last 2 weeks of May, to Utah. On the front end of the trip, we have 7 days booked in Moab as a base camp. This flexible itinerary includes 1 day in Arches, 2 days in Canyonlands, split between Island in the Sky with Dead Horse Point and the Needles District, and the other 4 days can be anything. We've considered a 2 day excursion to Goblin Valley, Capitol Reef, and Bryce Canyon, and another 1 day excursion to Goosenecks, Valley of the Gods, Moki Dugway, and Natural Bridges. Are we cramming too much, or is this realistic?
It would be nice if there were one central location in southern Utah that visitors could have a base camp and see all of these things. But the reality is there's just too much driving involved to stay in one town and go back and forth.
Okay, so let's break your itinerary down. For the parks near Moab, yes, you could do Arches in a day and then one day in Canyonlands, Island in the Sky District, and on your way out, stop in Dead Horse Point for sunset.
Then day three, you could drive to the Needles District, hike, and drive back to Moab. Now, that's about a 90-minute drive each way. And if you're going to do that, be sure to stop at Newspaper Rock and see the petroglyphs there.
Absolutely. But for the rest of the places on your list, we would suggest leaving Moab and booking other accommodations. So if you drive from Moab to Capitol Reef, that's going to be about a 2-hour drive with, of course, some additional time that you're going to need for a stop in Goblin Valley. Then you could explore Capitol Reef in the afternoon and stay in Torrey, which is a little town just outside the park.
Then the next day, you could drive back and forth to Bryce Canyon. It's a bit of a drive, about 2.5 hours each way if you drive Highway 12, but it's a really scenic drive. It's a beautiful drive.
Oh, yeah.
You'd still have enough time at the park to walk the Rim Trail or maybe hike down into the amphitheater. We love the Queen's Garden Navajo Loop.
Absolutely. And then the next day when you're leaving Torrey, don't drive back through Moab. Instead, from Capitol Reef, you'll want to go east to Hanksville and then take Highway 95 to Natural Bridges National Monument. This is a beautiful drive. It's about 2.5 hours, and you'll see new things along the way.
Then you can spend some time at Natural Bridges.
And, you know, you can drive to the overlooks of the bridges and stop and get out and take some pictures. You know, we hiked down into the canyon, walked through the canyon underneath the bridges and back up. And that, you know, that's at least a half a day.
You could then drive down Moki Dugway through the Valley of the Gods and stop at Goosenecks State Park to see that view.
Right, right. And we'd recommend getting a hotel room somewhere in that area, you know, either Bluff or Blanding or Monticello. And if you do it this way, this would work out perfectly with the rest of your trip since you'll be heading from Utah to southwestern Colorado.
So, yes, you could see all those places on your visit. Just tweak the 7 days in Moab.
Right, right. So moving on to part two of your question. For the second half of our trip, we have 2 nights in Durango and 3 nights in Ouray booked. What would you recommend for an easy ranger-led tour at Mesa Verde?
Okay. So Mesa Verde, I think our recommendation there for an easy ranger-led tour would be Cliff Palace.
So I jotted down some notes about each one. Now, Cliff Palace is a 45-minute long tour. You have to walk about 100 feet down a steep sandstone staircase. And then after you view the ruins to get out, you climb up 4 8- to 10-foot tall ladders. The whole walking distance is about 1/4 mile. I don't remember those ladders to be anything difficult to you, Matt.
No.
I mean, they were short enough that I think probably almost anybody could do it.
Right.
We think that's the easiest one. Now, one step more difficult from that would be Longhouse. And that's mainly because it's just a lot longer. It's a 2-hour guided tour, and it involves hiking more than 2 miles round trip.
There are a couple of ladders there, a couple of 15-foot ladders there, you know, a little bit more challenging. But, you know, I don't think they're... I mean, they set these things up for the general public, so I wouldn't be too concerned about the ladders. And the elevation change is like a 150-foot elevation change. So I think that's fairly easy physically.
Right. I think if you couldn't get Cliff Palace, then Longhouse might be your next choice. What we would not recommend if you're looking for easy is a Balcony House. This is the most adventurous tour in the park.
The park website said it's not for the faint of heart.
No, I don't think it is either.
There's one spot where there's a 32-foot ladder, and people who might be afraid of heights would maybe freak out on a 32-foot tall ladder. You also have to crawl through an 18-inch wide tunnel that's about 12 feet long. So this might not be for you if you're claustrophobic at all, or you think you might not fit.
I know. I was a little worried about fitting through there myself before we actually went into it.
Yeah, so was I. But we both got through just fine.
We did. And we've done it a couple times. And then the other thing, too, there is a 60-foot tall open cliff area with uneven stone steps that you have to climb and two more 17-foot tall ladders to exit. So if you're looking for easy, do not do this one. And I will say, too, when we've done the tour, you're gathering, this group is gathering above the cliff dwelling. You can't see the cliff dwelling from where you're waiting for the ranger. Then when you're all there, the ranger takes you, you know, through a locked gate, down along these steps along the side to this viewing spot where then you are looking into this alcove where the ruins are. And she said, this is the point. This is where if people want to turn around because they don't like what they see, this is the turnaround point. And anyone can stop at that point and go back up. And she said people do all the time once they view what they're getting into.
Okay, so those are some suggestions on tours through Mesa Verde. All right, Karen, can you look at the bottom of the mailbag and see if there are any questions left?
You know, Matt, it looks like we have one last one in here, and this one comes from Stacy in Greensboro, North Carolina, and she wrote, "We are planning our first trip out west to visit some of the national parks in May. We'd rather not have a schedule and an itinerary. How hard will it be to find campsites in the national parks without advance reservations, both tent and or RV sites?"
Yeah, I think our advice is it will be very hard and it will be filled with anxiety.
Maybe you're asking the wrong people, Stacy, but
we like to plan ahead.
We're planners. We like to know where we're going to sleep. And this first come, first served campsite thing drives us absolutely crazy.
Last September, we were driving from Nevada up to Craters of the Moon National Monument in Idaho. We were about 100 miles away from the monument, and there was a car behind us, and I had convinced myself that that car was also going to Craters of the Moon National Monument that's 100 miles away, and that that car behind us was also looking for a first-come, first-served campsite, and that they would pass us and get the last site. So this is the level of anxiety we have at 100 miles out.
I know.
It gets a little more intense as we get closer. I actually haven't run anybody off the road, but I would if I had to.
It's not pretty. We make a beeline for the campground. And then as we're driving through, you know, it's just filled with anxiety because you might see an empty campsite. But then do you grab that one? Because is that the last one that's available? Or is there a better one down the road? So sometimes I'll jump out and I'll stand in the empty campsite while Matt circles around and looks for a better one. Because we're just not good at this. We're very anxious.
We are anxious, but for a good reason. At the Craters of the Moon campground, we got there around 3 o'clock on a Tuesday in September, and the campground was full by 4. So there are a lot of people using the NPS campgrounds.
And the other thing, even if you're not anxious about it like we are, I mean, do you want to spend your day in the park, the time that you could be sightseeing and hiking and playing? Do you want to spend that looking for a campsite, circling and waiting for somebody to leave? I don't think most people would want to do that.
No. So Karen, how do we make reservations for campgrounds?
Well, you know, every single park is different. So some parks have one day that it opens up for the summer and everybody's on and they book the site and it's sold out, you know, in 2 seconds. And then others have a more staggered approach. So it just depends on where you're going. I know last summer we wanted to camp at Mount Rainier and we were able to, there were some sites that opened up 2 weeks ahead of time and we were able to get two really nice campsites in a great campground just 2 weeks ahead of time.
Yeah, so it can happen.
Yes.
I think the challenge is more if you're out for a week or two and you're going from place to place. I mean, that's, you got to get lucky every day.
Right.
Or every couple days whenever you move sites.
Now, another thing to look at, a lot of people have blinders on and they, when it comes to these campgrounds and they are only looking inside the national parks, But literally right outside the boundary could be a state park or a national forest that also has campgrounds. And those don't go as fast because people don't know to search for them. So I would definitely check those out as well.
Right. And also the Bureau of Land Management land a lot of times less developed, and they allow dispersed camping. So you have to check each site to make sure that that particular BLM land allows for dispersed camping. They'll usually have the rules on their website, but essentially any hard surface that's off the road that looks like a campsite, you can just pull up and camp there.
Right, and that's a good option too. So anyway, best of luck to you. If you can make reservations ahead of time, we'd suggest you do so. If you do go spur of the moment, we would suggest definitely have a backup plan if you can't get a campsite. So for us, because we're always so anxious, we know that the campground is full, then we're going to stay in a hotel. There's a town, you know, 2 hours away, and we make sure there are rooms available. So we know that we do have someplace to sleep that night.
Okay. Good luck, Stacy, from Greensboro, North Carolina.
That's right. I hope you have a wonderful trip. All right. And that is going to wrap it up for Mailbag for today. If you have a mailbag question for us, please send it to our Gmail account. And that is mattandkarensmith@gmail.com.
Thanks so much for joining us today. We'll be back with an exciting new episode next week.